So we better do this.
Hello, this is Adam.
Adam, hi. This is Greg Felber from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
And this is Kim.
Hi, how are you?
And this is Kim Schaefer from the same place. Thank you for making time for us today.
Sure.
We have a policy that we're supposed to tape conversations so they can be part of our archives. We'd like your permission to do that.
Sure.
Thank you. A minimal amount of bureaucratic introduction. As I guess you know, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission was established by Congress. We are holding a variety of hearings on the causes of the financial crisis, and will, we hope and expect, produce a report by December 15th to Congress and the President. And among the topics that we are exploring, and a reason for our seeking your wisdom today, is the topic of derivatives and how it may have related as a cause or a propagating mechanism of the financial crisis. And we're happy to turn it over to you to give us your view.
And I think we should, we try to start off with just, could you please just give us a brief background of yourself and what you do at your firm?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Adam White, as you know, and I'm the sole proprietor of White Knight Research and Trading. So I'm independent financial research consulting, and you know, I have several clients. My biggest client is Mike Masters, who runs a hedge fund. And basically, my background is accounting degree and then an MBA from University of Chicago and an internship at Bankers Trust, where I decided that derivatives were what I wanted to focus on. So my second year of B school onward, my career is pretty much focused around derivatives. So after school, I worked on the swaps desk for Swiss Bank, which later became UBS in a merger. And then after that, I worked for Coca-Cola in their treasury department, again, hedging with derivatives, and then worked for Masters Capital, again, focused on derivatives. Now, so interest rates, and then at Coke it was mostly currencies, and then with Mike it was mostly equities, and the last 2 years I've been working with Mike on a series of reports and testimonies in front of Congress involving bubble in commodity prices that was largely caused by institutional investors pouring into passive commodity indexes, again, through derivatives. So, again, more derivatives, this time commodities, for the last couple of years. So in terms of how did derivatives impact the financial crisis, you know, my belief is that, you know, every financial crisis has ultimately been caused by too much leverage. You know, if you're a Bear Stearns or somebody like that, and you have 30 or 40 to 1 leverage, then it doesn't take much losses before you go bankrupt. So derivatives certainly were a contributing factor, allowing people to take large amounts of leverage, because, you know, when you do a swap transaction between, say, a Citigroup or J.P. Morgan and another counterparty, it's pretty rare that J.P. Morgan would have to post margin with the other counterparty, at least initially. So they would get, you know, $10 million of dollars in free credit from that counterparty, or possibly more, when they do that derivative transaction. So, you know, if I wanted to buy, just using equities as an example, 100,000 shares of IBM, it might cost me, you know, $5 million. But if I want to do a swap, 100,000 shares of IBM doesn't cost me anything. So there is all kinds of embedded leverage in derivatives. The other thing is that when you, when your counterparty posts margin to you, then you can rehypothecate that cash and use it in other areas of the bank. So it's like, get free leverage on one hand, or you get, you know, essentially free cash on the other hand. So basically, you know, when people talk about derivatives, they talk about it like the they call it the shadow banking system. You know, the derivatives plus the special purpose vehicles and things that allowed, you know, the banks to do much bigger things than they were doing on their regulated side of their business through the use of derivatives. So then leverage obviously caused one, can cause any one institution to fail, but why would, you know, the whole system potentially come tumbling down? And of course, the answer is that, you know, all of these derivatives contracts are one-to-one, you know, counterparty-type things. So J.P. Morgan trades with Goldman Sachs with Morgan Stanley with Deutsche Bank, and there's all these contracts. And you don't know who has contracts with who. So you don't know, you know, who's exposed to Lehman Brothers. You know, there's rumors, and in that kind of environment, rumors, you know, run wild, but you don't really know. So there's this interlocking web of exposures where, you know, one counterparty potentially could be making money or could be losing money. You just don't know. You know, so things like, you know, Goldman Sachs saying that they were hedged against their exposure with AIG, of course you wonder, well, who were they hedged with? Because it's not clear that that person could have paid them if, in fact, AIG had gone under. So those was really the two ways I think that derivatives contributed to, you know, the collapse. I think probably they were really the main mechanism for the transference of systemic risk, because, again, like I said, nobody really knew who owed each other what, and that was kind of the primary reason for the panic.
You're mostly talking about the panic in September 08 after Lehman failed?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's kind of it.
Adam, have you done any original research or read any research that quantifies the leverage, that aggregate leverage that derivatives helped create?
No.
Okay.
The short answer is no.
Okay. I don't know that anyone has, but
yeah.
And as you well know, solid data in this area is limited, to say the least. So I wanted to allow me to broaden the question. Is there any good data sources that you have viewed that you liked?
Well, again, you know, that's the whole problem. If we had the data, then we probably wouldn't have had the panic, because the panic was over a lack of data, you know, that there was no way of knowing who owed, you know. I mean, Goldman knew how much they owed to all their people, but they didn't have any idea how much all their people owed to each other. And so that was what the panic was about, is that we don't have any data and we don't have any way of knowing who owes who what. So we can't really assess our counterparty risk at all. So I haven't seen any data. I think any academic stuff that comes out, it always takes, 1 to 2 years anyway.
Sure.
And then when it comes out, it'll all be anecdotal, because at the end of the day, nobody has the data. Yeah.
Well, we can try to get data in our jobs, but what data should we try to get, and where does it reside?
Well, you've got a very daunting task ahead of you, particularly given your time and money constraints. But yeah, I heard when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, they put out some data about their over-the-counter swaps portfolio, and Lehman was a minor player, but I mean, they had, over a million swap contracts or something like that, and they had, I don't remember the exact figures, but they had something like, billions upon billions upon billions of exposure, and I know that they're, the bankruptcy court's fighting it out right now over how much of that is real money that's really owed, in terms of creditors, and how much is not. But the point is that Lehman themselves, a minor player, had a huge amount of contract bond with all these different counterparties. And so, the way that you would have to do it, I suppose, is you would have to reconstruct that. Now, I would expect, here's another thought along those lines, is that generally you would imagine that as part of a risk manager's job, that risk managers should on a daily basis go to the CEO of the company and say, here's, our exposure, for instance, to our top 20 or top 100 counterparties. They should probably do that on a daily basis. So I would expect, for instance, that Lloyd Blankfein every night should be able to see, this is how much I owe to AIG, and this is how much AIG owes me, and so every night. So that kind of summary information is probably available and probably something that you could get.
Mm-hmm.
The detailed risk reports that are produced for the senior management on a, if not at least daily, but maybe they might even be produced, three times a day or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about exposures, I mean, I guess we're kind of making an assumption that firms would net out all of their derivatives, OTC derivative exposures, to another firm, and they would throw in the commodity swaps and the equity swaps and everything all in a basket? I mean, is that the way you would look at it?
They have, the ISDA master agreements have netting provisions that say, in the event of bankruptcy, if you owe me $8 million and I owe you $5 million, it's like you only owe me $3 million. And so they, I would think that they are calculating that, net exposure all the time. Now, the gross exposure is important too, because, if you owe me $8 and I owe you $5, I'm not going to send you the $5 if I think you're going to go bankrupt. You might, in other words, if the prices move and you have a margin call, I'm not going to send in the margin if I think you're going to go bankrupt. And that actually, of course, contributes to the downfall. But yes, I would think that the net amounts should be available.
And the ISDA master agreement covers amount
too.
And the ISDA master agreement would cover all. I guess we need to spend some time on this, but the ISDA master agreement would cover all OTC derivatives? I mean, it would say all net exposures?
Yeah, and that's the whole idea of a master agreement, is it covers everything. And it would cover, you know, and it would cover, like you say, you know, they might have little riders and addendums. If you, for instance, always traded currency and now you want to start trading, you know, commodities or something, there might be a little addendums to the agreement. But overall, that master agreement is going to dictate everything in the relationship.
Could we go back to your comment about embedded leverage?
Sure.
Does that apply differently in different types of over-the-counter derivatives? Is it only applicable to CDS, or is it to all of them?
Oh, it's to all of them. It's to all of them. I mean, you know, literally a derivative is just a contract. And so, you know, you can sign contracts where no money changes hands. And many of these, that's the way it starts out. So, yeah, they all have really infinite leverage at inception, because you haven't put up any money, and yet you've suddenly taken on this exposure.
I have less familiarity with equity derivatives. So I understand the math of infinite leverage, but in, let's say, interest rate and currency swaps, I'm just trying to think each of these types through a little, and since you have knowledge with all or a lot of them, asking for your help. You have an exchange, currency, interest rate. That's and although things can change radically, there's lots of data on historical boundaries of how those swings might occur. Could you educate us a little bit? And so intuitively, I think there is less leverage, if you will, in those two types of OTC derivatives, potentially when compared to other types. So, and if you disagree, you know, please tell me. That's why I'm trying to think this through. But then I'm less familiar with commodity and equity derivatives. More familiar, actually, with credit derivatives. But do you mind, like, talking a little bit through the leverage in those types? Because there's the argument on CDS is that you make a protection payment, but you could, in exchange for potentially receiving the full par amount.
Right. So I think it's very important to draw a distinction between leverage and risk. So risk is generally considered how volatile something is. So, you know, an internet stock might be a much more volatile than a utility stock. Because utility stocks, you know, tend to be more reliable because they've got a monopoly. You know, they don't move as much. So, you know, leverage, though, would simply be, you know, the amount of money that you have, you know, in your contract versus the amount of cash that you have backing up that contract. Now, there is a connection between the amount of cash you have and the amount, and therefore, and the risk associated with it. So they all kind of are tied together, but, you know, there's
Adam?
Hello?
I bet you he hit the phone.
I think he hit the phone because there's no light. So don't. just go back.
You didn't like us?
I'm sorry. What happened?
Whatever.
I'm talking on my cell phone, which is an AT&T iPhone, so I apologize for that. But
the connection is really clear. Wow.
Good. Well, it's clear as long as
as long as
clear
it
until
works.
It isn't.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that you can get, you know. Mathematically, you can get the same amount of leverage in any, whether it's interest rates, currencies, equities, commodities, you can get the same, you know, leverage, 20 to 1, 30 to 1, 40 to 1. The risk will be different in each one. The amount of cash that you would normally expect to put up would therefore be different in each one. So then the effective leverage you could get, you know, might in practice be vary from contract to contract, but you know, at least in theory that the leverage should be potentially the same all across the board. And you know, one of the issues, I think one of the big issues with derivatives is that generally how much money you have to put up, this is for over the counter derivatives kind of exclusively, is going to be based on your credit worthiness and not based on the risk of the transaction itself, in most cases, which is a problem. If you look, for instance, at the exchange and futures traded on an exchange, you know, the amount of margin you have to put up is based on how volatile whatever you're betting on is. Whereas if you're AIG and you're AAA, you might not have to put up any money at all, you know, unless things go significantly wrong and significantly in the wrong direction, and then you might have to. Which is essentially what I believe happened to AIG is they, you know, they were selling, you know, all this credit default insurance, and then they thought the risk was low, so they were not putting aside money for it, and then suddenly the risk was much worse than they thought. They had a huge margin call, and they didn't have the money. So I don't know if that answered your question directly. If not, maybe you could ask it again.
I guess it was more just my lack of familiarity with commodity derivatives and equity derivatives. So is there some, generally speaking, you know, larger amount of effective leverage that you would get in credit derivatives versus those types of derivatives, generally speaking?
No, I think the amount of leverage you could get is more going to be based on your credit worthiness. So, for instance, an airline doing jet fuel hedges, you know, they are not generally very credit worthy, so they might get $10 million of credit before they have to post margin, but if their losses exceed $10 million, then they've got to start, you know, kicking in cash. So it's really more a function of the fact they're an airline than a function. So the same trade between Goldman Sachs and AIG, same instrument, oil, and AIG might not have to kick in any money because they're just good for it. Or, you know, their threshold might be $100 million or $500 million or a billion or something.
Okay, I see. So you're saying it's really the counterparty rather than the derivative type that has the greater impact on leverage. Okay. Could we move back to your work related to commodity prices? And I don't know if that work related to commodity derivatives, And do you draw any connections between the commodity bubbles that you've been testifying about or preparing research about and the overall financial crisis? I just want to make sure we're not missing something, failing to think about something that you've spent time thinking about.
They're kind of related on two levels. One, they're related in the sense that the over-the-counter derivatives market being for the most part fully opaque market that you can't see, was, we think, one the kind of the hidden explanation for why we had what we believe was a bubble in oil prices in 2008, where we went from 70 to 150 in a year, and then went from 150 to 35 in 4 or 5 months. We think that that was really a function of money flowing into oil derivatives and others as well. Food, if you look at the charts, you can see we had a bubble in a bunch of different commodities, not just oil, but money flowing in and money flowing out is really what caused the rise and fall of prices. So that'd be one thing. They're related because it's derivatives and, it's kind of this hidden force underneath the surface. But more directly so, what was really kind of interesting is that there was AIG. Goldman Sachs is the largest purveyor of index swaps for the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, and AIG is number two, and really it's just a duopoly. There's nobody else doing commodity index swaps. And so AIG had a significant amount of money that pension funds had given to them to bet on the Dow Jones AIG Commodity Index. And the way these pension funds operate is they generally, if it's a $100 bet, then they're going to give the counterparty $100. So they have zero leverage. They're fully collateralized. And so AIG had sold substantial amount of these commodity index swaps. So we estimate that benchmarked to the Dow Jones AIG Commodity Index was perhaps as much as $100 billion. Now, some fraction of that would be with, you can actually sell the Dow Jones AIG Commodity Index if you're Credit Suisse, for instance. So not all that would be necessarily with AIG, but, if only half of that was with AIG, that's $50 billion. Well, we've been able to track fairly well the amount of money flowing in and out of these indices, and beginning in middle of June 2008, substantial amount of money started to flow out of these indices, like, 20, 30, maybe $40 billion, from mid-June to, say, September. And a big fraction of that was AIG. And so what's happening is AIG is having to give all these pension funds their cash back. And then, in September, of course, people really became concerned about counterparty risk. And another, I don't have the exact figures, but another, $30 billion or so came out. September, October. So those two things together were probably a significant cash drain for AIG, which did not help their financial position at all. Because they had sold these fully collateralized investments to pension funds, but then pension funds came to them in the middle of the year and said, we want our money back. And they had to give a lot of that cash back at a time when they really didn't have extra cash.
So what's your source on this?
Well, what you Our source is the CFTC has some data called the Commodity Index Trader Supplement that they've been publishing since 2006. And ISDA, International Swaps and Derivatives Association, had warned in a letter to the CFTC that you better not publish this data or it'd be fairly easy for somebody of reasonable sophistication to use it to calculate how much money is in each one of the indices and change from week to week would tell you how much is, you know, flowing in or out. So soybean oil appears in the Dow Jones AIG index, but it doesn't really appear in the other indices. So you can look at the amount of soybean oil and get kind of a proxy for how much is invested in the Dow Jones AIG index. If soybean oil is 2% of the index and there's $2 billion in soybean oil, then you know that there's $100 billion in the index. And we've been tracking that information since 2007, and it's been pretty consistent. So
does anybody else do this? Does anybody else do this?
Yeah. Yeah, there were other, Lehman Brothers, of all people, was doing it. They published some reports called oil.com and other stuff. So, yeah, it's a fairly well-established thing. There's actually an economist named Warren Mosler that was talking about how this had affected AIG.
How do you spell that?
M-O-S-L-E-R.
Can you send us your reports from that period?
Sure.
I don't think I'd be able to find it. Okay, can I find that on the internet somewhere?
Our reports?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a blog called AccidentalHuntBrothers.com. So it's AccidentalHuntBrothers.com. And in the top right-hand corner, it says download reports here. And if you click on that banner, then you'll get the reports.
Oh. So how did that tell you about AIG in particular?
What did it tell us about AIG?
Yeah, I mean, if this is an index trader, how do you know? Does it actually tell you a specific company's exposures?
No. No. No, but I mean, if you're a pension fund and you want to invest in the AIG index, you know, and AIG is coming in to see you, you would probably do it with them. You know. We know a guy that worked for AIG in their financial products selling their commodity index thing, and he kind of told us off the record, double secret probation, that we were pretty much right on the mark. I mean, you guys have the obviously the enviable position of being able to go to AIG and say, hey, how much did clients have invested in your index, and how much did they pull out in 2008?
What was the index called?
It's the Dow Jones AIG Commodity Index.
Oh, it's called the Dow Jones AIG Commodity Index.
Yeah.
I didn't totally follow you when you were describing how you could derive the value of it from the soybean oil. So you said that...
So the Dow Jones AIG Commodity Index has, I think it's 14, 16 commodities in it, one of which is soybean oil. The other, I don't know why I'm drawing a blank right now, but the other 15 or so are in the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index and in other indexes, so you can't really distinguish how much is AIG versus how much is Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
But soybean oil is pretty much only in the AIG index. And so you can look at how much commodity index traders own soybean oil, and from there you can You know, you can say if soybean oil is supposed to be 2% of the index, and we see commodity index traders own $2 billion worth of soybean oil, then you can assume that there's $100 billion invested in the index, because $100 billion times 2% is $2 billion. So you can back into it.
And you get the information on how much soybean oil the traders own from their 10Qs, or?
No, from the CFTC, Commodity Future Trading.
Oh, that's
trading.
Where that comes in, I see. And that's called the Commodity Future, what is that called?
Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC.
No, I'm sorry, what's the CFTC product you're talking about?
The CIT supplement, where CIT stands for Commodity Index Trader Supplement.
Got it. Okay. Well, that's an interesting anecdote to look into.
I'd love to know what you find.
Besides the AI, in addition to the AIG connection, are there other connections you want to draw between the commodity bubbles and the financial crisis?
No, I don't really see any other bubbles, that you can draw directly. I mean, any other connections you can draw directly. I mean, there's a general, there's a general mode of operations on Wall Street that, is going to want to profit, no matter, whether markets are going up or down, they're going to want to profit. So if people think markets are going to go down, then they're going to short, they're going to short it. And I think if you are at the center of the market, you probably have a better view on where things are going than, your average market participant. So, our philosophy is, in general, the flow of money is always what's going to determine prices. So, if money flows into the housing markets in large quantities, housing prices are going to go up. If you list your house for sale and five people show up with their checkbooks on day one, you're going to get a better price, all things being equal, than if nobody shows up or just one person shows up. But, the more money flowing into anything, whether it's internet stocks or, emerging markets or housing or commodities, the more the money flows in, prices are going to go up. If money flows out, prices are going to come down. You had this expansion in the money supply effectively through the shadow banking system and the use of derivatives, where people could make, even bigger bets because they were getting higher leverage. And so that was just exacerbated the situation. But, I think there are certainly people on Wall Street that could see the money flow and could bet accordingly, which is, there's a prevailing feeling of kind of efficient markets, and, it's up to me to do what I think I ought to do, and it's right for me to make a profit because, I'm helping to make the market more efficient. And it's kind of like the wolf looking at the lame buffalo, saying it's good for me to eat that buffalo because it helps evolution or whatever.
All right, let's go back to something you said before, because I'd really like to unpack it a little more. And forgive me, I don't mean in any sort of challenge or disrespect. I just want to understand analytically what you're saying.
Sure.
So you said that since OTC derivatives are fully opaque, it was a hidden explanation for the oil bubble and perhaps for other commodity bubbles as well. So just if you can, please explain kind of the mechanics of how the opacity helps contribute to the bubble.
So, you know, the way that you know, a hedge fund or a corporation like Coca-Cola or somebody would do a derivatives trade is they would, you know, come to the decision through analysis that they wanted to do a trade, and then they would call up, you know, they would call up banks, generally 1 to 3 banks to get prices from them, and they'd execute with the person that had the, you know, had the price, the best price. What's generally always going to happen is that that derivatives trader on the other side is going to have to hedge immediately this transaction that they've just done. So as an example, you know, if Delta Airlines calls up Morgan Stanley and says, I want to buy a 2-year monthly oil swap, then, you know, Morgan Stanley is going to immediately turn around and start buying crude oil futures on the NYMEX or the ICE to hedge that. You know, a wise old guy at Bankers Trust told me, you know, that the cost of a derivative is always what it costs to hedge and not necessarily what the theoretical models tell you. So what they're trying to do is a swaps dealer is trying to, first of all, charge the client as much as they possibly can, which is, I guess, the American way, relative to what it's going to cost them to hedge as much as possible of their risk. The less amount of risk they can hedge, the more amount of risk they can't hedge, the more it's certainly going to cost the client. So what you have, one of the reasons you only call 1 to 3 people is because if Delta Airlines calls up, you know, 20 people, then the entire street is going to know that Delta Airlines wants to do a trade, and Delta Airlines is only a buyer of jet fuel. They're not a seller of jet fuel. So, you know, that money, and in this case it's kind of funny money because there's no cash changing hands, but that effective transaction is going to move the market. It might, if it's a small transaction, might only move the market a little bit. But every participant knows that, and you'll find, and every participant knows that the whoever does the trade is going to have to hedge it. So you'll have front running going on. You'll have people buying ahead of time. And so what ends up happening is there's a, you know, every swap dealer wants to play their cards close to their vest so that they don't tip off the other guy who will try to take advantage of them. So if a swaps dealer can do a trade in front of anticipating someone else coming along and doing the same trade, you know, they'll do it all the time. So there's this, you know, there's this feeling of we're all poker players and we're all in competition with one another. We don't want anyone to know what we're doing. So, you know, they would, and that's one of the reasons that they will use brokers, because the brokers, interdealer brokers, can help them to kind of cover their tracks and not let anyone know what they're doing. So there's just a general sense of secrecy is necessary to avoid getting ripped off. And so there's always, you know, the guy at Goldman Sachs oil desk wants is for the guy at Morgan Stanley's oil desk to know what he's doing.
So what are your sources of price information in the over-the-counter market?
You don't have good sources of price information. You just hope that when you call 3 dealers that, you know, between the 3 of them, one of them won't rip you off too bad. I mean, you can look at the screens in certain markets, and you can get close to a good idea. Of, you know. So, for instance, the guys at Delta, the next 2 years of oil futures on the NYMEX, and they can see, you know, that prices range from 78 to 82. So, you know, I'm probably going to get a two-year swap around 80, which would be roughly the average of all those, you know. And so then if they call up, you know, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Cargill or somebody and say, you know, where are you on the oil swap? They're expecting that the guys are going to come back, you know, I'm $80.20, I'm $80.45, I'm $80.85. Okay, I'm going to go with the guy that's $80.20. Do they know, should the real price be, you know, $79.92? You know, they don't know that. They just know they're going to pick the one that's the cheapest and hope that, you know, that's about the best they can do.
So why are you in the swaps market? Why don't you just use the futures market?
They don't like to use the futures market for a couple reasons. First of all, when you use the futures market, you're having to post margin every day. So you're having to move cash in and out of your margin account every day because the amount that you are required to post changes every day. And two, the banks will give them, depending on your credit, they'll give you, like if you're Coca-Cola, they'll give you great, essentially free credit. They'll let you do the swaps transaction. There's no cash involved, you know, until you have to, on settlement date, send them a check or they send you a check. But it's, from their perspective, it's easier. And, you know, we've actually argued, hey, you'd be doing much better if you went, you did this transaction on the exchanges, but corporations just don't want to do it. There's FASB 133 kind of rules, and it's a little more complicated, and they don't want the hassle, and it's not part of their core business.
I don't understand what you mean. It's a hassle, and it's not their core business. I mean, economically, it's not that different, is it?
We have to define, we have to make a distinction between, for instance, cash flow and the, income statement. Technically, they could get a better price going to directly to the exchange, is my firm belief, but they look at it as, you know, if I'm going to do that, then I don't know how much cash it's going to involve, and, you know, it might be a significant amount of cash, and I want certainty around the cash that almost more than I want a great price. I'm kind of with you saying, well, you should be doing it on the exchange and, you know, getting a better price, but, you know, they're like, well, you know, it's basically too much of a hassle because we got to, you know, every day we've got to, you know, we could be at getting $10 million or receiving $10 million. And to me, that's not a big deal because, you know, you're the Treasury Department anyway. That's your whole job, is to balance the corporate checkbook. But, it's from their perspective, it's easy to do and it fits in with the way they budget everything and, you know, the way the budgeting process works. If you need, you know, if this month, you know, you're going to have to post $1.5 billion of margin, you know, that's a big deal, and we'd rather, you know, not have to do that.
So, go ahead.
I mean, at the end of the day, what you have is you have a bundling in the over-the-counter market. You have the derivative itself, but then you also have a bundling of the credit component. So in a lot of cases, like, a manufacturer could pledge property, plant, and equipment as collateral against their derivatives positions, and then they never have to post margin. You know, so it's a bundling of the credit. And if you say to your bank, well, you know, I would like to post collateral, property, plant, equipment to get a loan from you in order to post cash to trade derivatives on an exchange, they'll say, well, why would you want to do that? just come on over here. Let me introduce you to our over-the-counter swap dealer, who, you know, you don't even need any cash here. It's much better.
That's fascinating. So how much of the commodities over-the-counter market is economically identical, which is the way it sounds like, to the to instruments that are available on exchanges already?
Well, that's a big debate. I don't know if you follow the legislation and stuff, but, you know, the...
Well, no, I'm certainly familiar that they're trying to put over-the-counter stuff on exchanges, but I don't know, you know, to what extent what you're saying is, you know, your delta, you want to hedge your jet fuel. You can either do it through a commodity swap or through a future, and it's economically similar, but you choose the over-the-counter for other reasons. I mean, so to what extent would you guess, you know, you've got that kind of straight choice?
I mean, the answer is, here's the thing, is basically the futures markets are set up. There's two ways to compete in the derivatives market. There's two ways in which the exchanges compete with the swaps dealers. The swaps dealers offer what they call customization, and then the exchanges offer liquidity. And so in order to maximize liquidity, what everybody trades the same standard contract. So take oil as an example. Delta might say, I want a jet fuel contract that delivers jet fuel at, you know, Louisiana, you know, offshore oil port or whatever. That's probably not right for jet fuel, but just let's assume that's correct. Because that's the closest to Atlanta, which is their hub, you know. So they want the Louisiana jet fuel price, and there's a company called Platts, and there's others, Opus, and things that put out a price of every day, what's the price for Louisiana jet fuel. And they say, you know, I want that, and I want an average price for the month because I buy jet fuel every day, and I, you know, I want to do it that way. The exchanges offer one contract. It's a heating oil contract, which is heating oil and jet fuel are all, and diesel are all middle distillates. They're all very similar. So they hedge, you know, they trade very similarly. This is for delivery one day out of the month in New York Harbor. So, you know, we're all trading. People that want diesel, people that want jet fuel, and people that want heating oil are all trading, swaps dealers are all trading this heating oil contract, which is standardized as to delivery location, delivery time, and it's all heating oil.
Mm-hmm.
But, so then they turn around and they offer Louisiana to Delta on an average over the month. You know, and the difference between those two is called basis risk.
Right.
So swaps dealers, and then, you know, you can do a basis swap, and you could eliminate that basis risk as well. A lot of times, the swaps dealers will keep the basis risk because it's not that risky. So, I guess.
So another way of saying that, so if you're in your example, if Delta decides to go through the exchange rather than go through the swap dealer, they're avoiding the credit risk, but they're taking on basis risk.
Right, they're taking on a little basis risk. Right, that's right. So that's kind of the. You know, the dynamic right there. But the swaps dealer, the thing to know is that the swaps dealer will never trade a derivative that they cannot lay off the lion's share, the vast, vast majority of the risk somewhere. So the futures exchanges are kind of what the swaps dealers rely on in terms of risk transference. right now. So in terms of how much is standardized versus how much is customized, I would argue that 95% or more is standardized by virtue of the fact that at the end of the day, it's just gallons of jet fuel. Now, one guy's got an average over the month in Louisiana, and another is one day in New York, but for the most part, it's still jet fuel. And a gallon of jet fuel is a gallon of jet fuel, and there'll be a difference, a little difference in that. But for the most part, it's all pretty standard, and it has to be all pretty standard, because otherwise the swaps dealers could not lay off the risk, and they have to be able to lay off the risk.
So is that another way of saying that basis risk couldn't be that expensive to lay off?
Basis risk shouldn't be that expensive, period, to hold.
Right, okay. To hold.
Yeah. Right. And it's not, generally.
So what would be the impact of the legislation the way it's being discussed?
Well, all the legislation, there's... There's a whole different parts to this Dodd bill, but Title VII is the derivatives title.
Right.
And the centerpiece of the derivatives title is that over-the-counter derivatives have to clear through an exchange. So they don't have to trade on an exchange, but they have to clear through an exchange, meaning because at the end of the day it's all gallons of jet fuel, the exchange doesn't have to worry about liquidity when it comes to clearing because the trade has already happened, and all the exchange has to do is effectively assess the value of that transaction so that they know, should I collect money from counterparty A or counterparty B? Has it moved in A's favor or B's favor? In which case, I collect from the other counterparty and give it to the other person in their account. And what you have with clearing, which is why we think it's the solution to systemic risk, is you have an exchange, which is a third party, that becomes the central counterparty so that no longer is there an interlocking web? Now everything is through the central counterparty. And you have cash that is forced to be posted every day based on risk of the transaction itself. So the central counterparty's whole job is to say, how risky is this? What's the chance that in the next 24 hours this could go from here to there? I think it could go down 10%. Or I think it could go down 20%. If I think it could go down 20%, then I'm going to collect twice as much money. And that's based on historical figures, also based on different models. And so, to the point made earlier, you might be collecting more money for equities than you would be for credit default swaps or that kind of thing. But so the whole idea is to collect money every day. So what would the effective thing for that is that, first of all, AIG would have never been able to basically leverage their AAA rating into this huge derivatives portfolio with no cash attached to it. They would have had to post cash every day. So they wouldn't have had this cash squeeze. It depend on how much cash they had to post, it would have limited their leverage. So if the initial margin was 8% of the value of the trade, that means you can only get 12 times leverage. Because for every $100 of trading, you have to put up $8. You can't get more than 12 times leverage under that scenario. So leverage is limited. The ability for a cash squeeze is limited. And then on top of that, because every single participant knows that everybody is paying in the cash and making good on their bets every day, they don't fear, oh, what is this guy? What's going to happen to this guy, or what's going to happen to this guy, and that kind of. And there's, you know, there's more to it than that, but that's the general concept behind clearing. And then people have argued, well, we need to have exchange trading also. And I think the, you know, for exchange trading, it's basically exchange clearing plus exchange execution. So when you go from clearing to trading, all you really pick up is the exchange execution part, which is important for the best form of transparency, and I think it would be the best thing for end users in the market, but it's not essential for elimination of systemic risk, in my opinion.
Okay. Now, you told the anecdote, but I guess about the commodities index, but I guess I didn't understand exactly why AIG lost money with that. They had clients who were invested in the commodities index that wanted to pull out. But what was it, how did that result in losses for AIG?
It didn't necessarily depend on how they were hedged. It didn't necessarily result in losses. It resulted in significant cash flowing out the door. So that's one of the things that's perhaps counterintuitive about derivatives, is that losses and cash are separate. So in other words, what AIG had was they had an ever-increasing tab of IOUs, you know, where I owed money, and they had losses, but they never had a day of reckoning where they had to transfer the cash for those losses, until one day it was suddenly, okay, I need all my money right now. I mean, it was, you know, that's kind of like, well, I was going to say it's like a run on the bank, but it's not really like a run on the bank. It's just basically, you owed me $500 million, and then you owed me $600 million, and I didn't ask you for any cash, but now you owe me $1 billion, and I want all billion right now.
So what went wrong here? Was the problem that AIG didn't hedge itself? I mean, if you're going to have an index like that, that means you're taking the opposite side of something that could go up in value. So should they have been selling something short as a hedge?
In commodities business, I believe they were hedged. So again, there were no losses in the commodities business. The losses were in the credit default swaps on the mortgages and CDOs side of things, where they believe that, you know, house prices were never going to go down, and, you know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, the weird twist in all this is that the same professor at Yale, Gary Gordon, who had done the CDS risk models at AIG, had also written a paper that was expounding on the wonderful virtues of commodity index investing.
Okay. I didn't realize that. That's fascinating. Did he also do that as an AIG person?
Yeah, well, yeah. AIG paid him to write this academic paper.
About the commodity index investing?
Right.
So if they were fully hedged, then why was it a cash call on them? I'm sorry, I'm still not getting this story.
Because people wanted to unwind it. So in other words, what happens is CalPERS, the pension fund, reads the AIG paper, reads Gary Gordon's paper, and says, you know, I think I ought to invest in a commodity index, and I think I'll invest in the AIG index because I like those guys and I like their presentation. So let's call them up, and we want to put $500 million into the AIG commodity index. Mm-hmm. And they say, great. Send us the cash. So CalPERS wires them $500 million in cash, and AIG promises through a derivatives contract to pay them the returns on the AIG commodity index. And then presumably they would go out and hedge that AIG commodity index by buying futures in each one of the commodities, the 19 commodities that are part of the AIG index, and in the exact proportions of the AIG index, they would buy these commodity futures, and then they would roll them over on the prescribed days and all that. So when that money goes from CalPERS to AIG, AIG then goes out and buys all the requisite futures in the right proportion. And, you know, that has an impact on the price of each one of those futures. It drives the price up. So then, you know, repeat that process over and over with the state of Missouri and, you know, the Commonwealth Fund and all these other pension funds are all getting into it. Now, so then, you know, middle of June comes around and prices have skyrocketed and Congress is holding all these hearings about the oil bubble and, you know, people are screaming and the economy is not doing great. And you say, you know, I don't think this is going to last. I think I'm going to take some money off the table. And so they call AIG and they say, you know, we have $500 million. It's grown to $800 million. We would like to take half. We'd like to take $400 million out. AIG says, okay. And they go out. You know, they had, when they got that $500 million from CalPERS, they went and used that in some other part of their organization. It's not actually sitting in a trust account, you know, a segregated account somewhere. They took that cash and used it, you know, for something else. Maybe they used it to pay off one of their credit default plots. I don't know. So now they have to take $400 million from somewhere else in the organization and wire it back to CalPERS. And then they, when they do that, they sell all their futures that they have, half of everything that they have in CalPERS account. They sell that. That drives commodity futures prices down, and the cash comes out of the organization. So when you do that enough times, suddenly $20 and $30 billion come out of the organization, and the treasurer of AIG is saying, hey, you know, our cash balance is down quite a bit. And by the way, now we've got to go post a whole bunch of cash to Goldman Sachs and, you know, Deutsche Bank. And we thought we had $30 billion cash because we had that money from CalPERS and all the other pension funds, but that's gone because they all wanted their money back.
Got it.
Their cash back. So they didn't lose any money on the commodity, but they, that whole pile of cash that they were sitting on is gone.
Got it. Fascinating. So, how about Lehman? I mean, there's a theory out there that Lehman was, I guess, first that it was run by hedge funds who basically pushed up the price of the credit default swap, which might have helped push the company over the edge. In fact, the same story is told about Bear.
Yeah. By the way, how much longer do you think you want to go? I mean, I can always talk a different time. I probably have to run in,
oh, okay,
you know, 10 or 15 minutes. I didn't know. I had only set aside an hour. I'd love to talk some more. I'm just...
Yeah, that would be fine. I'm learning a lot, and we can definitely sign off whenever you like and maybe reschedule another call.
Okay. So let me answer your question then, and then maybe we'll set up another call.
That would be great.
So
yeah.
In terms of, you know, Lehman and Bear and all those things, again, you know, there's no doubt that there were speculators that were speculating against Lehman and Bear. There's no doubt about it. Now, you know, I mean, and the modus operandi
Hello? Oh, now we lost again. Hey, Ken, wake up. Hello? Off again. We're about to wrap up.
All right. Sorry about that.
Okay. You just started talking about Lehman and Bear.
Yeah, so the modus, you know, we heard that what people were doing is they were, you know, they were shorting the credit default swaps. They were, you know, they were buying protection, shorting the credit. They were going out and shorting the stock. Not necessarily did they have stock to borrow. So, you know, there are people that say it was naked short selling of stock. And then they're buying the puts. So they're doing all of these things, all of which are bearish bets, all of which are, you know, for the most part, is fairly illiquid markets where you don't have to do a huge amount of trades to move the market, because again, money moves the market. So if I, you know, I could go out and I say, you know, I want, I don't know, maybe as little as $10 million in protection on Lehman Brothers, and that could move the market, you know, substantially. Mm-hmm. It gives the impression that Lehman's in trouble, you know? And so part of this is the whole notion that the market's always right, and that we live in the efficient market, and that the market's, you know, this entity out there that sends signals stuff to people. You know, the market's telling you something. I don't know if you've heard people say that, but
oh, you bet.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like, it sounds a little like the market's a deity or something. So there's this, you know, there's this feeling of if the market is this nebulous factor, then I almost owe it to the market if I think that Lehman Brothers is going under to short their stock and buy the puts and sell the buy protection on the CDS and all this, because after all, it's the market, and I can't really influence the market. I can just participate. And, you know, so it's like people either feel like their trading doesn't have an impact, which would be, I guess, the benign case, or the malignant thing would be, you know, they think that their trading does have an impact. They know it has an impact. They want it to have an impact. They set out to make an impact. And they succeed, but they feel like that's what they're supposed to do. Like I said, you know, they feel like I'm the wolf supposed to call the herd, you know, or whatever. So, you know, and they say I'm right. You know, Lehman is a house of cards. So it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy in some sense of, you know, if enough people bet against the company, then it will go bankrupt. You know?
So you wouldn't buy the argument that it could have been some market manipulation, or you're just saying it's hard to tell market manipulation from somebody who turns out to be right?
Yeah, it's hard to tell. Especially when they are right, you know?
Right.
I mean, there was this company, that just last quarter, no, it was end of 2009, YRC Worldwide, Yellow Roadway.
Right.
So this big trucking company, probably the biggest in America, 30,000 employees, all Teamsters union members, that, you know, they were trying to do this debt swap to buy themselves more time, because they, like everyone else, got crushed, particularly by this other bubble, you know. So, but then they found out that Goldman was selling credit default swaps on their, you know, on their debt, and I think they believed, you know, I'm just going by what I read in the papers, but they believed that, you know, they would sell them some bonds, but then they would sell them, you know, much more credit default swaps on those bonds, and they would, you know, and then of course, how did they hedge that, right? Because what I said is every dealer's got a hedge, you know, they would hedge the credit default swap. Dealer would hedge by buying puts on stock or shorting stock or that kind of thing. Because in the case of bankruptcy, the stock's supposed to go to zero. So, you know, YRC found out about this and went to Goldman and said, you need to work with us, not against us, or you'll have trucks circling this building, you know, and you know, we're going to raise such a stink that, you know, you're going to be upset that you mess with us, and, you know, it's Jimmy Hoffa and all this stuff. And so Goldman said, okay, we'll work with you. And then sure enough, the deal gets done, you know, within a couple weeks. And it's like, I mean, that right there is like an example to me of, you know, if speculators hadn't ganged up on Lehman Brothers to try and kill it, effectively, then maybe they would have survived. Maybe they could have gotten a, you know, some kind of structured type thing, you know, or a Bear Stearns kind of thing or whatever, but you know, it didn't happen. So I mean, I don't think necessarily that I don't believe that I mean, basically in over the counter land there's no such thing as manipulation. I don't think there's any laws against manipulation in over the counter derivatives.
Hmm.
Because the CFMA basically said this is to be an entirely unregulated market. I believe that there are fraud statutes because there is a state fraud statute in every state that just governs business contracts. And these are business contracts, but other than that, it's the Wild West.
Okay, well, I know you said you had to go, so thank you very much for your time. This was really very interesting, and I appreciate it.
We both do.
And we might try to set something up again next week when our schedule's clear again.
Okay, great.
So thanks very much.
All right.
Take care.
Have a good one.
You too.
Bye.